Welcome back to The Deep Dive, where we take a stack of source material, peel back the layers on the cultural icons who shaped the world, and really try to extract the real story.
That's right.
Today, we are undertaking a deep dive into the life of the novelist and poet who is just synonymous with youthful rebellion, the open road, and spontaneous creation. We're talking about Jack Kerouac.
We are. But the Jack Kerouac we think we know, you know, the hedonistic, perpetually wandering figure, that's really only half the story.
Right.
Our mission today is to conduct a really comprehensive exploration of Jean-Louis Le Brie de Kerouac. Mm-hmm. He was a pioneer of the Beat Generation, of course, alongside William S. Burroughs and Allen Ginsberg.
The big three.
The big three. But he was also, and this is the key, simultaneously deeply rooted in French-Canadian Catholicism and what is for many a startling political conservatism.
It's a huge contradiction. And if you're looking for the learner's shortcut to Kerouac, it pretty much begins and ends with On the Road.
Of course.
His 1957 novel that brought him, I mean, overnight fame and cemented his legacy as the voice of a generation searching for truth in movement. The themes are just. They're undeniable. Wow. Jazz, drugs, travel, poverty.
But that's a surface reading, isn't it? That kind of superficial take misses the fundamental, constant exploration running just beneath the hood. Kerouac's work is a spiritual quest.
Always.
It's a continuous tension between his Catholic spirituality and a later, very intense study of Buddhism. He wasn't just seeking kicks, which is what critics always threw at him. Mm-hmm. He was seeking salvation.
And that tension, that's what leads us to the crucial cognitive dissonance at the heart of his whole identity. I mean, he gave the world the language and the aesthetic for the 1960s counterculture, the hippies. And yet he utterly rejected the very movement he helped create.
He did. He was the progenitor who became antagonistic toward the political radicalism of his own literary children. It's fascinating.
He was the ultimate square peg in the beet hole.
He really was. He was celebrated as this great revolutionary, yet he remained an anti-communist traditionalist who insisted, and I'm quoting here, "I'm a Catholic, not a beatnik."
So our source material today is vast. We're drawing on biographies. He's, what, 13 novels? And volumes of poetry.
Yeah, a lot to get through.
And we're going to use it all to map the distance between his public image and his intensely private, paradoxical worldview.
Okay, let's do it.
Okay, let's unpack this by starting at the beginning. Because the roots of this paradox are buried deep in Lowell, Massachusetts. And in a language many people just don't associate with the great American novelist.
Exactly. Kerouac was born on March 12, 1922, to French-Canadian parents Léo-Alcide Kerouac and Gabrielle Ange Levesque. And this is absolutely critical to understanding him.
The background.
He wasn't just of French heritage. He was raised speaking French, or what he called joual, which is the specific Quebecois vernacular. That was his first language.
So he didn't even speak English at first?
No, not at all. That's a profound linguistic foundation. He only began learning English around age six, and by all accounts, he spoke with a noticeable, marked French-Canadian accent well into his late teens.
Which means the fundamental structure of his interior monologue, the rhythm of his thought, was shaped by this Francophone world.
Right, not the dominant American one. It explains so much about his later experiments with sound and spontaneity in his writing.
So when he's looking for a voice, he's almost filtering English through the cadence of a different language.
I think that's a perfect way to put it. And you see how deep this connection remained. Towards the end of his life, when he's just overwhelmed by fame and disappointment, he expressed this desperate desire to reconnect with his parents' native tongue.
And he actually did, right, in his writing.
He did. In 2016, we saw the posthumous publication of La Vie est dommage, a volume collecting previously unpublished works that he wrote entirely in French. Yeah, these included the novella Sur le chemin and La nuit et ma femme. This wasn't just, you know, some sentimental whim. He was actively creating in this unique linguistic space.
And how was his French? Was it academic?
No, that's the interesting part. He often disregarded standard French grammar in favor of phonetics just to capture that raw spoken Canuck French dialect of his childhood.
He was always chasing authenticity.
Always. And his ancestry was part of his self-mythologizing, too. While his father was a potato farmer from Quebec, Kerouac claimed all these varying, often romanticized origins for his surname.
Like what?
Oh, you know, Irish, Breton, or Cornish. He even tried to relate it to Kernowick, the Cornish language. It's like this constant search for a deeper, more romantic pedigree than the harsh reality of working-class Lowell.
But the spiritual bedrock that came from his mother, Gabrielle.
Absolutely. She was a deeply devout Catholic, the only woman, Kerouac later claimed, that he ever truly loved.
And this is where the lifelong suffering narrative really begins.
It is. The family was devastated by the death of his older brother, Gerard, from rheumatic fever at age 9 in 1926. Gerard's death wasn't just a tragedy for the family. For Jack, he internalized it as a profound, sanctified loss.
He later immortalized him as this saintly figure in visions of Gerard.
Yes. And the sources detail this one moment that essentially scripted Kerouac's entire life. His first confession in 1928 when he was just 6 years old.
This is an incredible story.
It is. For penance, he claimed to hear God speaking directly to him.
At 6 years old.
At six. Telling him he had a good soul, but, and this is the core of it, that he was predestined to suffer in life and die in pain and horror, though ultimately he would receive salvation.
That's less a religious experience and more a psychological manifesto for his whole life. I mean, how could you possibly live a mundane existence with that kind of prophecy hanging over you?
You couldn't. It's an impossible weight. It essentially gave him a theological justification for the chaotic path he would eventually take. The suffering was mandated, but the salvation was guaranteed.
So when he later integrates Buddhist concepts of suffering, dukkha, and detachment, it wasn't him rejecting Catholicism.
Not at all. It was a perfect, tailored fit. The search for detachment in Buddhism dovetailed perfectly with the Catholic concept of accepting penance and seeking grace through suffering. It's a powerful narrative of cosmic destiny.
And his father, Leo, he went the other way after Gerard's death.
Completely. He abandoned his faith entirely, chose drinking, gambling, a path of just cynical dissipation.
Yeah.
Kerouac consciously chose the suffering and seeking path instead of the outright rejection his father took.
Now, before he became the great spiritual wanderer, he was a physically gifted kid, a jock, really.
Yeah, this often surprises people. He was a capable athlete, played football and wrestled, and earned a scholarship offer that ultimately landed him at Columbia University in 1940.
But his time at Columbia was brief.
Very brief. He broke his leg during his freshman football season. By his sophomore year, he was arguing constantly with the coach, Lou Little, and just dropped out entirely. He did spend a short time later at the new school, but Columbia was done.
But Columbia was pivotal for one reason. The connections.
Absolutely. While there, he befriended Seymour Wise, who later becomes Lionel Smart in his books. And Wise was instrumental in introducing him to avant-garde jazz, especially the new radical sounds of bop.
This is the moment the intellectual engine starts revving.
It really is. Bebop, with its frantic, nonlinear improvisations, its speed, its intellectual challenge, that was the sonic blueprint for his future writing.
The rhythm he needed to match the speed of his thought.
Exactly. He was trading the rigid structures of the gridiron and the Catholic Mass for the unstructured freedom of Charlie Parker and Dizzy Gillespie.
So you have the foundation right there. The French rhythm, the Catholic suffering narrative, and the revolutionary energy of bop jazz.
A very volatile combination.
So dropping out of Columbia meant staying in New York's Upper West Side.
Right. In this intellectually charged yet highly chaotic environment of the city. This is the true birthplace of the Beat Generation. This is where Kerouac becomes inseparable from Allen Ginsberg, Neil Cassidy,
the future Dean Moriarty,
the one and only, and William S. Burroughs and Lucian Carr. This is the core group.
And their collective identity as these literary outlaws, it was violently cemented in 1944.
Yes, by the Camera murder. A shocking, formative event that put all of them under police scrutiny.
So what happened exactly?
Lucian Carr murdered David Camera. Carr claimed it was self-defense against what he described as Camera's aggressive, obsessive homosexual pursuit. He stabbed him with a scout knife and, in a fit of panic, dumped the body in the Hudson River.
And here's where Kerouac gets directly implicated. He didn't just know about it.
No, he helped Carr. He aided the cover-up by disposing of the murder weapon and burying Camera's eyeglasses. It's a moment of desperate, confused loyalty among friends in a really intense situation.
And this led to his arrest.
Yes, as a material witness.
Mm-hmm.
And the sheer desperation of the circumstances is captured in how he made bail. His traditionalist, conservative father, Leo, who had already abandoned the faith, he just refused to pay.
So in a truly bizarre and instantly legendary move, Kerouac married his girlfriend, Edie Parker.
On August 22nd, 1944. Because her parents agreed to pay his bail on the condition that they marry immediately.
a marriage of necessity, not love.
Completely. It was annulled in 1948, but it's an absurdly high-stakes anecdote that illustrates the chaos the nascent Beats inhabited. Life and death were intertwined with mundane things like bail money, forcing these grand, desperate gestures.
And crucially, the event was instantly viewed as literary material.
Right away, Kerouac and Burroughs collaborated on the novel, and the hippos were boiled in their tanks about the murder.
Which wasn't published until, what, 2008?
That's right. But it showed how immediately they recognized the dramatic potential of their own lives. Kerouac also mined the experience later in Vanity of Deluas. This formative trauma really defined their collective narrative. They were outsiders, defined by transgression and loyalty.
We should probably note that this murder incident was preceded by his failed attempts at a more conventional life during World War II.
Yeah, his military service. He had served as a merchant mariner from July to October 1942. During that time, he wrote his first novel, The Sea Is My Brother.
Which he himself dismissed as a crock as literature. Why was he so harsh on it?
Because he felt it was trying too hard to be a conventional novel about man's simple revolt from society as it is. He was using a conventional narrative form, a form he hadn't yet mastered, to capture a radical idea. He hadn't found his voice yet, only his theme.
It was published posthumously in 2011.
Right. And his actual military career ended even faster in 1943. He served only 8 days in the U.S. Navy Reserves before being honorably discharged on psychiatric grounds.
The diagnosis was schizoid personality.
Yeah, and his famous quote to the medical examiner, "I just can't stand it, I like to be by myself," it reveals a deliberate rejection of conformity, but also, you know, perhaps a shrewd manipulation of the system to get the solitude he needed for writing.
That's a challenging question. Was this genuinely debilitating antisociality, or was it a convenient excuse to avoid the discipline he viewed as antithetical to true inspiration?
It's hard to say. If he craved discipline, which his spiritual life suggested, why reject the physical discipline of the Navy? Perhaps the discipline he sought was internal, a spiritual structure, not an externally imposed secular one.
So he retreated.
He did. To Ozone Park, Queens, living mostly with his parents, a period his friends joked about, calling him the Wizard of Ozone Park.
But that solitude produced his initial output, including The Town and the City, which he wrote between 1946 and 1949, and the first conceptualizations of what would become the great American road novel.
Okay, so let's look at that first artifact the world saw. The Town and the City.
Published in 1950 under the name John Kerouac.
Right. And it was influenced heavily by Thomas Wolfe, an author known for these sweeping semi-autobiographical generational epics.
It's a very traditional literary structure.
Very. It focused on the generational contrast between small-town life and the pull of the metropolis. But critically, it was heavily, heavily edited. His editor, Robert Giroux, convinced him to cut roughly 400 pages.
400 pages. Wow.
And this experience just deeply frustrated Kerouac. He felt his natural, expansive voice was being mutilated by conventional expectations.
That heavy editing really sets the stage for the radical departure that was on the road.
It was his declaration. His declaration that he would never let a conventional editor dictate his pace or structure ever again.
Precisely. So the writing of On the Road in 1951 became literary mythology.
Total mythology. He completed the final draft in a phenomenal 20 days while living in Manhattan with his second wife, Joan Haverty. The intensity required was immense.
And the sources detail the physical aids that sustained this burst of creative energy.
Oh, yeah. Joan supplied him with a constant stream of benzedrine and amphetamine, along with cigarettes, pea soup, and coffee. It was a chemical and dietary regime engineered for relentless, continuous output.
But it's the physical mechanism that truly captures the imagination. The scroll.
The scroll. He'd take sheets of architectural tracing paper, these long, continuous sheets, into a single roll, 120 feet long, and he fed this into his typewriter.
The purpose was to eliminate the slightest interruption. He wanted to maintain a pure, unadulterated stream of consciousness flow, never having to break concentration to reload a page.
This was the physical manifestation of spontaneous prose.
And the scroll itself, which was uncensored and used the real names of his friends, was a raw document.
Very raw. When Viking Press finally agreed to publish the novel in 1957, after years of rejection and struggle, they demanded major revisions. The original scroll was just too explicit in its sexual content and too risky in its use of real names for fear of libel suits.
So the famous book that we all read, the one published in 1957, was actually the censored revised version.
Yeah, it was stripped of some of its raw edge and used pseudonyms like Dean Moriarty for Neil Cassidy. It took until 2007 for On the Road, the original scroll, to finally be published, giving the world Kerouac's true unedited vision. That scroll later sold for $2.43 million.
Wow.
And we have to revisit Kerouac's own description of the book's core theme because it explains his fury at how it was received. He was adamant it was a story about two Catholic buddies roaming the country in search of God. He constantly emphasized that Neil Cassidy, the primary engine of the road trips, was sweating for God.
He believed the public and the critics completely missed the profound spiritual yearning.
Completely. They saw only the superficial kicks.
Which brings us to the formal technique he developed, spontaneous prose. This wasn't just random scribbling, it was a deeply intellectual, synthesized method.
Derived from two major influences, bebop jazz and later Buddhist ideas.
The jazz connection is so key.
It is. He wanted to translate the sound of a musician's improvised solo, what they called the lick, directly onto the page. Bebop is fast, unpredictable, and it avoids the predictable cadence of traditional composition. Kerouac wanted his sentences to mimic this.
And the Buddhist concept he borrowed was breath.
Exactly. In meditation, the breath is the focus, continuous and flowing. Kerouac conceptualized his writing as one long, continuous breath, the outflow of the mind. And that's why revision was minimized, because it would disrupt the original pure expulsion of thought.
The punctuation reflects this musicality too.
Oh, absolutely. He famously eliminated the period, which acts as a hard stop.
And substituted it with a long connecting dash.
Yes. The dash creates a bridge between ideas, forcing the reader to maintain the relentless pace and rhythm of the prose, much like a jazz drummer doesn't completely stop between beats.
Now, this technique wasn't universally loved.
Not at all.
Truman Capote's famous dismissal, "That's not writing, it's typing," that really encapsulates the conventional literary establishment's horror at this seemingly undisciplined approach.
It does, but it was revolutionary for his peers. Allen Ginsberg became his major proponent, directly crediting Kerouac's spontaneous method with inspiring the structure and composition of his landmark poem, Howl.
And Kerouac eventually formalized this approach, right? It wasn't just a vibe.
No, he formalized it into 30 detailed maxims, published as Belief and Technique for Modern Prose. It demonstrates that the method, though it might seem chaotic in result, was rigorously intellectual in concept.
It's also fascinating how he returned to his roots using this technique. When he wrote fiction in French, he applied the same spontaneous approach.
Yes, specifically relying on phonetics to capture the sound of his native dialect. He deliberately ignored standard French grammar or spelling in works like Sur le chemin and La nuit est ma femme.
Which proves that the drive for spontaneity was fundamental to his personality, not just a gimmick for English language rebellion.
Exactly. He wanted to capture the authentic, unfiltered sound of language, whether it was the fast-paced urban rhythm of bop or the specific, unvarnished sound of his childhood tongue. He was inventing a new literary vernacular rooted in his deep traditional past.
So this technical experimentation, the spontaneous prose, was completely intertwined with his lifelong spiritual hunger.
Completely. His interests were truly Catholic with a small C. They encompassed sacred texts from India and China alongside American literary giants like Emerson and Thoreau.
And his serious engagement with Buddhism. That began in 1954. It was an attempt to synthesize his Catholic foundation with a more mystical Eastern philosophy.
It was. And the trigger was discovering Dwight Goddard's A Buddhist Bible at the San Jose Library.
That book, particularly the Diamond Sutra, had a profound impact on him.
Oh, huge. He considered it one of the most influential texts he ever encountered. And he didn't approach it casually. He applied the same rigorous discipline he once had for Catholicism and football.
Really? How so?
Well, our sources confirm that he studied the text intensively, adopting a highly structured, repeating weekly cycle. He dedicated one day to the study of each of the six paramitas, the six perfections, and the seventh day to the concluding passage on samadhi, or deep meditation.
That is methodical. That 7-day cycle of structured devotion, it speaks volumes about his need for order and discipline, which contrasts so sharply with the apparent chaos of his road life.
It does. And he produced works reflecting this study, including some of the Dharma, which was an imaginative treatise that blended poetry, prose, and religious reflection.
He also wrote Wake Up, A Life of the Buddha.
Yes, a biography of a Buddha, which was serialized posthumously.
And the practical application of this spiritual search led him to Gary Snyder.
The brilliant poet and environmentalist, a key figure in the San Francisco literary scene, Snyder was a deep practitioner of Zen.
And Kerouac deeply admired him. Snyder served as the basis for the character of J.F. Ryder in the Dharma Bums.
Right. And following Snyder's lead and seeking ultimate solitude and detachment, Kerouac took a job in 1956 as a fire lookout on Desolation Peak in the North Cascades of Washington.
You have to imagine the scene.
Yeah.
Total isolation, high up in the mountains.
And his sole reading material during this period was the Diamond Sutra. It was the ultimate test of his search for samadhi.
And that solitude, combined with the energy from On the Road's success, that's what fueled his next major novel.
It did. The Dharma Bums was written incredibly quickly, between November 26 and December 7, 1957, in Orlando, Florida. He returned to the continuous flow method, typing the manuscript onto a 10-foot length of teleprinter paper.
So in a way, Dharma Bums was his deliberate attempt to correct the record, to show the world that the beat search was fundamentally spiritual, not just reckless.
I think so. However, the spiritual journey didn't bring peace. The fame following On the Road meant that his private spiritual practices were now subject to public scrutiny and criticism.
Mm-hmm.
Established figures in American Buddhism, like Zen teachers Ruth Fuller Sasaki and Alan Watts, they were skeptical of his blend of Catholicism, bop, and instant Zen.
He felt like a monstrous imposter,
but
didn't
he? He really did. He wrote agonizingly to Snyder about a meeting with D.T. Suzuki, the legendary scholar, claiming Suzuki looked at him through slitted eyes as though I was a monstrous imposter.
That's rough.
This self-doubt, amplified by his escalating alcoholism, it led to demoralization. He declined an opportunity to reunite with Snyder, explaining that he felt too decadent and drunk, and that he didn't give a shit about his past commitments. This self-rejection culminates in his public declaration, I'm not a Buddhist anymore.
So it seems the structure and tradition he found in Catholicism and sought in Buddhism were just constantly undermined by the freedom and chaos that he, paradoxically, celebrated in his own writing.
And the shift from obscure writer to cultural icon was just instantaneous and brutal.
Right. July 1957, he's just moved into a quiet place in Orlando, and Gilbert Milstein's review in the New York Times drops.
And it didn't just review a book. It announced him as the voice of a seismic shift, the herald of a new generation.
And the fame, which you think would be liberating, it became a cage. It was an unmanageable surge that, by his own account, rapidly became his undoing.
This is where the core paradox really solidifies, because he spent the rest of his short life trying to dismantle the image the press had created.
He actively resented the label, the king of the beat generation.
Viciously.
Yeah.
When confronted, he pushed back sharply, stating, I'm not a beatnik, I'm a Catholic. To emphasize the point, he even showed a reporter a painting he had personally executed of Pope Paul VI.
He was trying to signal to the world that his core loyalty was to tradition, to faith, not to the fashionable, messy rebellion he was now representing.
And the political dimension of this conflict was particularly intense.
In what way?
Well, Kerouac was fiercely traditional and staunchly anti-communist, which set him apart ideologically from peers like Ginsburg, who were rapidly moving left. This wasn't a subtle drift rightward. This was his lifelong stance.
And we have firm documentation on his political leanings, which, you know, often shocks people who only know On the Road.
It does. In 1952, he publicly endorsed Robert A. Taft, who represented the conservative, pre-Eisenhower old right of the Republican Party.
And the pattern continued. Hunter S. Thompson noted that as late as 1964, Kerouac was a staunch supporter of the arch-conservative Republican candidate, Barry Goldwater.
William S. Burroughs, a close observer, confirmed that Kerouac consistently maintained very traditional values, always was conservative.
It's a fascinating dissonance. He embraced the ascetic freedom of jazz, drugs, and sexual exploration, but politically and spiritually, he desired rigidity and established order.
Right. He was against the external constraints of society, but for the external constraints of faith and flag.
He even found himself in a peculiar spot during the McCarthy era.
A very strange spot. He reportedly watched the 1954 McCarthy hearings while smoking marijuana and rooting for Senator Joseph McCarthy.
Seriously.
Seriously. He saw the fight against communism as a necessary spiritual war. His anti-communism was tied up in his Catholicism, viewing it as the ultimate materialist evil.
And his academic disdain for left-wing thought is evident in his writing.
Very evident. In Desolation Angels, he critiques his time at Columbia, noting that all they attempted to teach the students was Marx, which he dismissed as an illusory tangent. classifying Marxism alongside Freudianism as distracting, secular pseudoscience.
And this antagonism just boiled over when the hippie counterculture emerged in the 1960s.
Oh, he saw them as fundamentally lacking the spiritual depth and intellectual rigor of the original beats. He was openly critical, believing the movement was an excuse to be spiteful and self-indulgent. He infamously deemed hippies mindless, communistic, rude, unpatriotic, and soulless.
This ideological chasm led to profound personal conflict.
It did. By 1968, the tension resulted in a decisive split with Allen Ginsberg, his longtime literary collaborator and confidant. It really signaled the fracturing of the original beat core.
The fame also brought immediate physical danger.
Yes. After only about 9 months as a celebrity, he felt profoundly unsafe in public. He was badly beaten by three men outside the San Remo Cafe in NYC, a traumatic event that underscored how his public persona attracted violence.
And his friends suffered too. The book's notoriety meant Neil Cassidy, whose real-life antics are now public record, was easily set up and arrested for selling marijuana.
Right. The freedom Kerouac wrote about in the 40s quickly turned into confinement and legal peril for those involved.
So Kerouac used his earnings to retreat.
Instantly. He purchased the first of three homes in Northport, New York, where he sought refuge with his mother. The man who wrote the ultimate travel narrative retreated instantly upon finding fame, seeking the quiet solitude that had birthed his earlier work.
The freedom he wrote about meant constant motion. The freedom he sought meant safe domestic stability with his mother. A huge contradiction.
And the later 1960s were just marked by an accelerating personal decline.
Pounded by a series of devastating personal losses.
Yeah, his sister died in 1964. His mother suffered a paralyzing stroke in 1966, which demanded constant care from him.
And then the death of his muse, Neil Cassidy, in Mexico in 1968. That must have been a huge blow.
It severed a core connection to his past. He was losing his emotional and inspirational anchors one by one.
His final public appearance gives us a poignant and really painful snapshot of his state.
It does. It was on William F. Buckley Jr.'s intellectual debate show, Firing Line, in 1968.
And he appeared visibly intoxicated.
Very, slurring his words at times. But he used the platform to vehemently affirm his deep Catholicism and rail against the counterculture. Buckley, the quintessential conservative intellectual, seemed intrigued but also just confused by this drunken traditionalist who was simultaneously seen as the prophet of hedonism.
A perfect, confusing coda to his life.
It was.
And Kerouac died tragically young on October 21st, 1969, in St. Petersburg, Florida, at the age of 47.
His health had been deteriorating dramatically due to decades of alcohol abuse. He suffered an acute esophageal hemorrhage. He was vomiting blood and was rushed to the hospital.
The cause was severe cirrhosis.
His liver was so damaged it couldn't produce the necessary clotting factors, and he essentially bled out.
And there was also a grim contributing factor, a final, fittingly chaotic detail.
Yes, an untreated hernia that he had sustained in a bar fight just weeks before his death.
So a physical complication born of the disorderly life he both championed and abhorred.
Exactly. He died in a state of physical distress, fulfilling, in a dark way, the prophecy he believed he had received during his first confession at age 6, that he would suffer in life and die in pain and horror.
Though he certainly believed in the ultimate promise of salvation.
Always.
He was buried back in his hometown at Edson Cemetery in Lowell, Massachusetts. At the time of his death, he was living with his third wife, Stella Sampas Kerouac, but echoing his lifelong devotion, his mother, Gabrielle, inherited the majority of his estate.
And here's a massive financial contrast for you. The estate was valued at a paltry $91 at his death.
$91.
Reflecting his struggle to maintain any financial stability amidst the chaos. But by 1998, due to the enduring prestige of his literary legacy, that same estate was valued at $10 million.
The prophet died poor. The artifact became immensely valuable.
But despite the tragedy of his final years, his legacy is just absolutely immense.
It is. Kerouac's works didn't just influence literature. They fundamentally changed the rhythm and aesthetic of popular culture and 1960s rock music.
The list of artists who owe a debt to his prose is remarkable. Bob Dylan, The Beatles, Patti Smith, Tom Waits, Jerry Garcia of the Grateful Dead. His spontaneous, free-flowing language provided a template for lyrical rebellion.
The most direct acknowledgement, perhaps, comes from The Doors.
Oh, absolutely. Keyboardist Ray Manzarek was explicit, stating that if Jack Kerouac had never written On the Road, The Doors would never have existed.
That's a powerful claim. It suggests Kerouac was not just an inspiration, but a structural necessity for the band's existence.
And his influence transcended genres. His name is an instant cultural touchstone. It appears in songs like 10,000 Maniacs, Hey Jack Kerouac, in tracks by the Beastie Boys, and even in modern country music.
Right, Doakes Bentley mentions, Kerouac gave me a book of poems.
See? His literary technique permeated the very cadence of American song.
His institutional legacy also reflects his complex relationship with spirituality and poetry.
It does. In 1974, Allen Ginsberg and Ann Waldman opened the Jack Kerouac School of Disembodied Poetics at Naropa University, a Buddhist institution. This act canonized him not just as a novelist, but as a poet whose techniques deserved formal academic study within a spiritual context.
And we find physical tributes across the country. Kerouac Park in Lowell, Jack Kerouac Alley in San Francisco's Chinatown.
The house in Orlando where he wrote the Dharma Bums is now preserved as the Jack Kerouac Writers in Residence Project.
In a nod to his wanderlust, even a crater on the planet Mercury was named in his honor in 2015.
That's amazing.
But for readers today, the most valuable part of his continuing legacy are the posthumous publications that reveal the author as he truly was, before the commercial pressures took hold.
Absolutely. The publication of On the Road. The original scroll in 2007 was a monumental moment. It allowed readers to compare the raw, unedited, continuous flow of his initial vision, complete with the explicit content and real names, with the version that the reading public had consumed for 50 years.
He showed us what pure, spontaneous prose looked like before the market demanded censorship and revision.
And we also got the publication of his collaboration with Burroughs on the Camera Murder, and the hippos were boiled in their tanks in 2008, giving context to that traumatic, formative event that bonded the early Beats.
And finally, the 2016 release of La Vie est Dommage and his French novellas Sur le Chemin and La Nuit et ma femme.
Which confirms his unique linguistic contribution. He used spontaneous prose in French, relying on phonetics rather than standard grammar to capture the specific sound of his childhood tongue. This reinforces that his linguistic inventiveness was a deeply personal foundational drive, reaching back to his roots even as he pushed literary boundaries forward.
So if we zoom out, the story of Jack Kerouac is really about the impossible tension of American genius.
I think so.
He was a conservative, Franco-American Catholic, raised on tragedy and visions of suffering, who became the accidental revolutionary figure by synthesizing the rhythm of jazz and the philosophy of Buddhism.
And he used spontaneous prose to try and find an immediate pure truth, yet he constantly strove for God and order amidst the chaos he created.
That tension, the Catholic Puritan who gave rise to the hippie, that's the enduring image. He embodied rebellion, but his heart remained fiercely rooted in tradition.
And what's fascinating here is how much of his fame rests on a technique, spontaneous prose, that was predicated on minimal revision and pure, raw output.
Yet, as we've discussed, we know his first novel was heavily edited against his wishes, and his most famous work, The Legendary Scroll, was censored and revised for its initial publication.
He aimed for pure, unedited truth, but the world accepted the polished version.
Which raises an important question for you, the listener, to mull over as you navigate the road ahead. We have the artist's pure intent, the raw, continuous stream of consciousness captured on that 120-foot scroll.
And then we have the enduring artifact, the revised, published book that the public consumed and lionized.
So what does this conflict between intent and artifact tell us about the true nature of creativity? Does the value of the art lie in the artist's spontaneous truth or in the enduring, polished piece that the world finally accepts? Something to think about.